Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The pandemic is touching lives across the world, and yes, people are suffering. So many folks across Appalachia are pulling together to help one another.
I see the community and the networks and how strong and resilient we are. A lot of times we say that we're modeling the new world and that we're building the world that we want to live in.
While people are helping each other, is the federal government doing enough? We'll check in with small business owners. Many say they're confused and frustrated by the government's small business loan program.
Either you don't know anybody or maybe one or two people somewhere that got some money, but not very much.
Some large businesses are reporting concerns about food shortages, while some Appalachians are looking back to an earlier time to feed their families.
We've ended up crossing paths with really incredible people who are very enthusiastic about sharing everything they know. And that's just the only way this stuff's going to get preserved.
These are some of the stories you'll hear this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. The coronavirus pandemic is affecting all of our lives, whether we're working from home, worried for our health, or unexpectedly out of a job. As Mr. Rogers used to quote his mother during a crisis, look for the helpers. And there's no shortage of those in our region. One group hit particularly hard during this pandemic is younger people. Many across Appalachia and the U.S. work hourly jobs and now are out of work. Sydney Bowles brings us a story from Central Appalachia, where several young people are banding together to offer each other support during these tough times.
Micaiah Davis lives in Big Stone Gap, Virginia. He's 23, and until recently, he was a server.
So I went working at the Woodbugger up in Northern Virginia. It's a restaurant, and the governor announced there's no more dining. I am currently about to file for unemployment as we speak.
18-year-old Lara Helene of Mount Sterling, Kentucky, says she's also struggling.
I'm a musician. So all of my gigs through the beginning of June have been canceled. So I've lost a lot of income. And then I live with my grandparents, and I also, my great-grandparents and my great-uncle live on the same plot of land as us. And they're all immunosuppressed. So I've been doing all of the errand running, all the grocery shopping, while also trying to keep up good grades and then also do mutual aid work.
Mutual aid. It's a phrase at the heart of a youth-led campaign that arose in response to the coronavirus. The Youth Mutual Aid Fund is a partnership between the Stay Together Appalachian Youth Project, or STAY, and KSEC, the Kentucky Student Environmental Coalition. STAY Project Coordinator Lou Murray says the idea started when area schools started to close.
When Berea closed, was all of a sudden, it was that realization of there are a lot of young people who are going home to places that, or don't have places to go to. And there were, people coming from West Virginia University who were I'm worried that I'm going to have to walk 2 miles to the library to get access to internet.
Casey Gibson, a coordinator with KSEC, had a similar idea.
I reached out to Lou just to see if Stay was doing anything because I figured we were probably on the same wavelength.
Working together, Gibson and Murray raised money and announced that people under 30 could apply for up to $200 for things like rent, groceries, internet hotspots, medication, or gas money. Mutual aid, the organizers said, is just people helping people.
It's that basic human principle of reciprocity.
For these young people, the work that's happening now is about more than crisis support.
A lot of times we say that we're modeling the new world and that we're building the world that we want to live in. And we can really see that now. And I look at people who are doing movement work of all kinds, and I see the community and the networks and how strong and resilient we are. And I can see how much we have for each other and how much we have to give each other and to hold each other.
We can't go back to the system of the way that we've been living our lives for so long. We have the opportunity to completely transform our communities.
For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles.
Mutual aid is central to how Appalachian communities have weathered previous economic hardships, and those who know Appalachia's labor history will recognize there's a common theme here: working class people joining forces. Pretty much everyone is facing a lot of uncertainty right now, wondering what will happen when the lockdowns lift across the nation. Many working class people in Appalachia work in the service industry, in restaurants, stores, hotels, and in seasonal tourism jobs. These industries face an uphill battle in the months and years ahead. You've probably heard there's some federal aid coming from Washington. It includes support for small business owners. But the first loan program ran out of money shortly after it went online, and we now know that some of the funding went to larger companies while many smaller businesses lost out. In fact, 99% of businesses in West Virginia are considered small businesses. Some business owners applied for federal assistance through a loan program which helps with daily operations. Others applied to the Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, that provides cash to workers. We talked to more than a dozen small business owners in Appalachia to find out about the application process. Here are three of them.
Beginning of the pandemic, we decided to just close for 2 weeks for safety reasons for our customers and for our employees and ourselves as a family. But once we knew that this pandemic would not go away anytime soon, we knew that we needed to open up somehow. Our revenue has gone down 80%. We roast coffee, we sell it, and that originally was a goal of ours to increase our online sales. And that's happening in a forced way, but we're looking at making it more of a targeted, specific avenue of business. I never heard back on anything we've applied for, except for we're still working on it. Unfortunately, it's businesses like mine that are seeking the revitalization of small towns that aren't being helped.
The SBA has been almost radio silence since we submitted our application, and the Paycheck Protection is not happening right now, apparently. But it seems like for all of our other small business owner friends in the area, like, either you don't know anybody or, like, you know maybe one or two people somewhere that got some money, but not very much. I mean, it'll be a huge and very pleasant and welcome surprise if something does come through for us. But from the process itself and from the little bit of information that we're getting just through the general media trying to figure out what's going on, I'm not exactly holding my breath.
I did not apply for the PPP because my folks all went on unemployment. And so what I applied for was the EIDL. I ended up getting $8,000 from them. And actually, it was a little odd in that I applied for it. It was a very simple application, and they never responded. And then I opened up my bank account to pay some bills, and there it was. You know, when I'm looking at money and I'm looking at budget, I'm planning to be out of commission in any kind of full-time way until the end of June. It's really rough, and it's, you know, there are no trust funds up here. You know what I mean? Everybody is just kind of pulling it together and taking care of each other. Frankly, at the motel and at Cooper House, I get such great guests. I miss them.
That was Joy Malinowski, who owns the Billy Motel and the Cooper House Bed and Cocktail in Tucker County, West Virginia. Before her, we heard Beth Bedway of East Willing Clay Works and Michael Irvin of Coal River Coffee in St. Albans. The EIDL that Joy referred to is the Economic Injury Disaster Loan, a program which is meant to help businesses with payroll, debts, and bills that would have been covered had the pandemic not occurred. The PPP loan is different. It's meant to keep businesses from laying off employees. And when it comes to the PPP loan, the majority of folks we talked to tried but didn't get this type of loan. It's first come, first served. What has this really meant for small businesses? Our staff talked to a number of people, and Inside Appalachia producer Roxy Todd is here to share what we learned. How many businesses got loans in the first round?
Here in West Virginia, just over 7,800 businesses got a loan. That's as of April 16th. But a lot of these loans are still being processed, so that number is likely outdated. That's according to the West Virginia Small Business Development Center, which is through the State Department of Commerce.
And businesses that want to apply for a PPP loan need to apply through a bank or other certified lender.
That's right. And the process is really confusing for folks. And we've heard from a number of people, they've just had a lot of different types of experiences based on their relationship with their local banker. Everything is just happening really quickly. And I think bankers, as well as small business owners, are just really struggling to keep up. Let's listen to two people. One got a loan and the other didn't. The first is Patrick. He owns an outdoor adventure company in Tucker County.
We are the fortunate recipients of the first wave of PPP loans. The way I was able to get that loan was essentially because I have a neighbor who is a small business coach, and she prodded me to get that loan in quickly. I got my application in the day before they started taking applications.
Meanwhile, in Fairmont, DJ Castle is hoping for good news. He owns the Ramblin' Root restaurant. He didn't receive a PPP loan in the first round. He got nothing from the SBA other than a confirmation number. He says sales are down by more than 40%, and he had to lay off 10 of his 12 staffers.
But it's to the point now, I'm not holding my breath on getting any of this stuff, which sucks because, you know, I'm doing everything I can right now to keep the lights on and the doors open here, but if I don't get some help, then if we close down, I don't know if we'll ever open back up.
Wow, that's really sad. To think about all these new businesses, it seems we've heard about that have opened as part of an investment in the state and our people. A lot of people are looking for different ways to diversify our economy here in West Virginia and other parts of Appalachia. And now all of that could just go away because of the pandemic. That's so sad.
I should also mention that the federal government's first bill, the CARES Act, also includes money for the Economic Injury Disaster Loan Program. That money is specifically used to help businesses with operating expenses. According to the Small Business Administration, just under 30 businesses in West Virginia received that loan as of April 16th. But that number has already grown because thousands of loans are still being processed every day.
Wow. And do we know what the economic impact could be if the small businesses who need a loan to stay open never get one? I mean, how many jobs are we talking about here for West Virginians?
Okay, here are a lot of numbers, but it's really sobering when you add it all up. According to the SBA, more than 113,000 businesses in West Virginia are considered small businesses. And that's almost 99% of all businesses here in the state. Their employees make up about 275,000 folks. And with this first round of funding, only about 6.5% of all small businesses in the state actually got one of these PPP loans. So we're looking at a lot of people not being able to return to work, and at least some businesses closing for good. Unless this new round of funding from the federal government is more evenly distributed among small businesses.
With this $349 billion, which has just been approved by Congress to give additional funding for small businesses, will these folks who didn't get a loan in the first round get one now that there's more money?
Well, the amount of money is actually not much more than the first time around. So the short answer is no. This is not enough money for every small business affected by the coronavirus to get what they need. What remains to be seen is how much of this next pot of money will go towards smaller businesses, like the folks who just have 12 or 20 or 50 employees. And these folks are really critical to our local economies. You know, the bookstores, the restaurants, the mom and pop shops who, frankly, will not open their doors again unless they have more assistance from the federal government.
Wow. Okay. So what kind of impact will this have on Appalachia?
Like everything, it's up in the air. I keep thinking about communities that are trying to diversify their economy, especially in those communities where coal jobs have really dried up in the recent years. This could be a really big blow. A lot of business owners we spoke to who were denied for the PPP said they aren't even clear on what the next steps are, whether those who didn't get loans in the first round will be in the pipeline for round two. We wanted to hear from one expert on how this could all play out. Here's Deborah Martin, director of the West Virginia Small Business Development Center.
Thinking about the ones that don't have options is what keeps me up at night. We're well aware that the programs that have been as generous as they are not going to be there for everyone. And so there will be some companies that don't survive.
Sounds like there's not much hope unless Congress does something to make sure these small businesses get what they need, or consumers really make an investment into their local establishments. Lots of questions that still need answers. We'll be digging into this more in the weeks and months ahead. Thanks a lot, Roxy.
Thank you, Jessica.
The second round of PPP applications began on April 27th. According to the Small Business Administration, within 2 days, 960,000 loans worth nearly $90 billion were approved, and more than half of these loans were filed through smaller-sized banks. The agency also offered an 8-hour window when only smaller bankers could apply for loans to increase the ability for more smaller businesses to get their loan application submitted this time around. As of Friday, May 1st, when this show was recorded, the PPP was still taking loan applications. By the way, since we're naming a lot of different government programs, we've posted links on our website where you can learn more about them. That's at wvpublic.org. As some businesses slowly prepare to reopen, several tourist attractions in southern West Virginia are wondering about what COVID-19 might mean for their upcoming summer season. Caitlin Tan and Emily Allen report how some of these businesses are adapting, how they're struggling, and what it all might mean for their communities.
This time of year, the Hatfield-McCoy Trail System in southern West Virginia is usually full of ATV riders and noise. But for towns along the trail system, like Bramwell and Mercer County, it is quiet these days. The Hatfield-McCoy trails have been closed since March 20th to comply with the governor's COVID-19 social distancing orders. Typically, those ATV riders would be bringing their dollars to the Bramwell Corner Shop and Diner, says manager Mandy Fink.
This time of year, we would be doing 5 times as much of what we're doing right now. I mean, at least that.
The corner shop, like most restaurants throughout the state, is serving takeout orders only. And that change hurts, Fink says.
We have a lot of local people that love the corner shop and they eat here, but we also have a lot of revenue that comes off the trails. And with the trails closed right now, none of that's happening.
For many locally owned businesses in southern West Virginia, warmer months bring in the majority of revenue. It's when people are most likely to visit. Take Adventures on the Gorge, a rafting and outdoor tourism company based in Fayette County. This is what a normal summer day might sound like.
Right, forward and back. Forward and back. All right, you're not using your arms. Let's try it again. Everybody rock forward. Put the paddles in the river. Now rock back. Now do it again. Now do it again.
Here's CEO Roger Wilson.
It's a 100-day war. It starts in June 15th and runs through roughly September 15th. That's when majority of our people are coming here.
Wilson's company employs some 400 workers every year. Right now, they'd normally be training new raft guides, but this year they're depending on returning senior guides to save money and avoid overcrowding. To help with paychecks, Wilson says Adventures on the Gorge received a Paycheck Protection Program, or PPP, loan through the first relief package passed by Congress.
If we had not gotten it, one, there would be about 34 people laid off immediately. It would have made opening up for us really hard.
According to the National Federation of Independent Businesses, the country's largest small business association, about 80% of small businesses in the U.S. have yet to hear back about the loans they applied for. That includes the corner shop in Bramwell. Manager Fink says they applied in early April and still haven't heard anything back, almost a month later.
We definitely have so many employees that cannot work at all, and those of us who are working, you know, at least half the hours that we typically would. Myself, for example, I usually work 38 hours a week, and I'm maybe getting 18.
In some of the most distressed southern counties, many of these businesses serve as much-needed opportunities for employment. But at many of those places, hours are reduced, and some people are out of work.
And just outside Fayetteville is the Arrowhead Bike Farm, another tourism-based small business that has a bike shop, restaurant, beer garden, and camping sites. Co-owner Rich Ireland says most of his employees are receiving unemployment. But like Adventures on the Gorge, the bike farm also secured a small PPP loan, which can be used for paychecks and some overhead costs. Although they aren't in peak season yet, Ireland says he worries how many people will be vacationing this summer.
I think we'll have a season. I don't know how good. I don't know if it'll meet our expectations, but hopefully it'll be, you know, one of those where we just took a growth year pause.
At the Meadow Bridge Drive-In in Fayette County, owner Howard McClanahan is usually open from May to October, the first 3 months of which are the most important for revenue.
We've just been taking our time this year because we know we're not going to get to open, and I don't see us opening before 1st of June.
It's expensive to run a drive-in theater. McClanahan says when he first took over in the 80s, each year needed maybe a couple thousand to open.
This past year, it's gone up to like almost, say, around $9,000 just to get open.
There's a risk this pandemic will hurt them years from now. Not only is the Meadow Bridge Drive-In a longstanding institution open since the 1950s, but it's one of a few drive-ins left in the state.
And Rich Ireland, from the bike farm, is one of those concerned about the lifespan of the small businesses that give West Virginia so much character and draw tourists from the region.
I think that it's going to be a shame if all that's left are big chain restaurants or, you know, big stores.
Indeed, reports indicate that quite a few nationwide chain businesses did qualify for the small business loans, but at least a few of them have returned the money. In Boone County, in the town of Madison, Tina Merlin is a tattoo shop owner who's trying to open a coffee house. She says she was unsuccessful applying for loans as well. Merlin says this pandemic could hurt shops like her own in communities that have been trying to rebuild since the decline of coal.
Main Street and little towns like this, there are lots of little things like that, and they're trying to revitalize the communities. So this is really bad for small, struggling towns who are trying to rebuild.
Several of the small businesses interviewed that didn't qualify for a loan say they plan on reapplying again for a tiny fraction of the $370 billion Congress passed last week for the second round of loans.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Emily Allen.
And I'm Caitlin Tan.
Up next, we learn about a music camp in eastern Kentucky that teaches girls and gender nonconforming youth the connection between music and activism.
I was able to find some confidence musically and personally.
We don't really realize like how much of a necessity that is, you know, to have confidence in ourselves. You know, that's not conceited. That's not bad to love yourself, you know?
That's coming up after the break. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
Thanks for listening this week to Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. If you enjoy stories of the people of Appalachia, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. You can find it at wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia or wherever you get your podcasts. Subscribe so you can listen to the show on your own time. If you're like most Americans, you've probably received a fair number of emails in the past month or so trying to sell you something or ask you to support a cause or a fund for unemployed workers. Many of these messages frame their pitch on the suffering and discomfort so many people are facing and offer some sort of product or political cause as the solution. Nobody has captured the essence of this better than Jessica Salfia. Salfia is a creative writing teacher in the Eastern Panhandle. She posted her poem, "The First Lines of Emails I've Received While Quarantining," on Twitter. It went viral with more than 46,000 shares and 169,000 likes. Salfia spoke with our associate producer Eric Douglas through Zoom. And don't you just love all these weird pandemic tech lingos we're all suddenly using? Let's listen.
As quarantine began, we all started getting emails from every company who we'd ever given our email addresses. And most of the same things about how they cared about their customers and were looking after their employees. Most of us simply deleted those emails and moved on. But you wrote a poem based on those emails using the first line from each one. Where did you get the idea to turn those first lines of emails into a poem?
I encourage my students to keep what we call a writer's notebook. And this is sort of an informal writing journal, and we do like some, we'll start a writing prompt in our writer's notebook, but also they're supposed to keep it and sort of capture writing in the wild when they feel inspired or when they see things that they want to imitate. And I always try to model for my students the kind of writing I want them to be doing in my classroom. And so I had my writer's notebook out, and as I was getting these emails, I noticed that language in my email inbox was changing. And so about 3-4 weeks ago, the language was very intense. Everyone was trying really hard to sound sincere. And I kept seeing these same phrases pop up over and over again in these uncertain times. As you know, many people are struggling. We hope this finds you and your family safe. And it all started to sound very lyrical to me. So I just started keeping track. And then as we progressed further into the pandemic, I started seeing that language move away from true sincerity to marketing veiled as sincerity.
Poets and poetry often express what we're feeling or seeing. Why do you think your poem has been shared so much? I mean, it's resonating with people.
I think the reason the poem is resonating with so many people is because, like any other art, people can bring to it the thing that they need to bring to it or take away from it the thing that they need to take away from it. And so the reactions to it have been really diverse. Like, some people think it's hilarious and have sent me emails like, oh, this made me laugh out loud. Some people have found it strangely moving and sad and poignant. You know, I teach a unit on art as argument to my advanced placement language and composition students. And we focus mostly on visual art. And we talk a lot about how art is subjective and that audience really plays a role in how art is interpreted, and that's the goal of good art, is that the audience can bring to it the thing that they need to bring to it.
Here's Salfia reading her poem.
The first lines of emails I've received while quarantining. In these uncertain times, as we navigate the new normal, are you willing to share your ideas and solutions? As you know, many people are struggling. I know you're up against it. The digital landscape, we share your concerns. As you know, many people are struggling. We hope this note finds you and your family safe. We've never seen anything like this before. Here are 25 distance learning tips. As you know, many people are struggling. Feeling fiesta today? Happy Taco Tuesday. Calories don't count during a pandemic. Grocers report shortages as more people are baking than ever. As you know, many people are struggling. Count your blessings. Share your blessings. Get free curbside pickup or ship to your house. Chicken, lemon, artichokes. As you know, many people are struggling. How are you inspiring greatness today? We have a cure for your cabin fever. Pandemic dial-in town hall tonight. As you know, many people are struggling. Mother's Day looks a little different this year. You're invited to shop all jeans for 50% off. Yes, buy one, get one free. As you know, many people are struggling. Call us to discuss a loan extension without penalty. Act now. Tell Congress charters should not line their pockets during the COVID crisis. Now shipping face masks as recommended by the CDC. As you know, many people are struggling. this is not normal.
I think she nailed it. And maybe the normal is simply sincerity that's missing in those messages. For some of us, it comes naturally. Sophia is a creative writing teacher in Martinsburg, West Virginia. We've posted a version of her poem on our website at wvpublic.org. COVID-19 is causing unimaginable human loss across the globe. Today on the show, we're looking at some of the long-term challenges we're all facing from the pandemic. Economic hardship, joblessness, small businesses closing. On another front, nationally, the coronavirus may also be disrupting the meat processing supply chain. Local farmers across Appalachia are at an advantage over larger companies, especially farmers who raise their own meat. According to the latest numbers from the National Agricultural Statistics Services, there are about 23,000 farms in West Virginia, and most of them are family-owned, supporting themselves from what they produce. Caitlin Tan spoke with one farming family doing just that.
Just outside Fayetteville, West Virginia, is Deep Mountain Farm, a 42-acre farm that has just about everything. Chickens, lambs, sheep, produce, dogs. In fact, a new litter of Great Pyrenees puppies, who will become guardian dogs for the sheep, were born the night before I spoke with Christine Wyrick. She owns and operates the farm with her husband, Chris Jackson, and their two young daughters.
Oh my gosh, they were born like in the middle of all that rain we got last night. I can't believe we have nine. We've never had such a big litter before, but they're all doing wonderfully.
Deep Mountain Farm is a regenerative farming operation, meaning they work the land with an eye toward improving and enriching the soil. Practices include everything from using cover crops rather than tilling the land, not using pesticides, and livestock grazing rotation. Christine says on a regular basis, they move the livestock to different pastures to give each area time to regrow. Christine and Chris have been operating the farm for 4 years now. They're able to live mostly off what they produce at this point. And although they have less help than usual because of the pandemic, the farm duties still go on as normal, like scooping feed in the barn. Christine says she and Chris both grew up in Kanawha County with limited knowledge on farming.
We've ended up crossing paths with really incredible people who are very enthusiastic about sharing everything they know. And that's just the only way this stuff's going to get preserved.
She says that's what's unique about farming in West Virginia. The rich traditions and knowledge of old farming practices and the willingness to share it with the younger generation. One practice Christine learned was how to grow a full garden, like one that a family can live off of and then some. And also how to can vegetables and fruit to eat in the off-season, something that was common on early farms in Appalachia. And this year, Christine says they're growing a garden larger than ever before.
I had like 400 kale plants. They're old seeds. I was like, these won't come up. I'll plant way more than any. They all came up.
Their hope is to have leftover produce to sell to people who are trying to social distance and stay away from grocery stores. Also, they'd like to donate some to homeless shelters.
I always can with my grandma and my aunts and my mom comes out. I mean, like, we fill the house up with people and jars and pots of food boiling away. You know, like, and now it's just going to be me. So I won't be able to put up as much food as we usually do. So I feel obligated, almost, to make sure that the food ends up in the hands of people who really need it.
They also produce chicken, lamb, and cow meat, too. And nestled into the herd of meat cows is the family's one dairy cow. Christine says her girls love to pet the cow.
What a good cow. What a good cow.
Christine also makes 100% lard soap, sometimes with a splash of raw milk from the cow. She's a firm believer in using all parts of an animal.
I have probably like 150 pounds of fat in my freezer right now because people don't know what to do with it. which is a shame because it's really easy to render lard, and then you don't need to buy any oils from the store, and it's really good for you, like full of vitamin D. But anyways, I could go on forever about lard. It's great.
Another good use for lard is lots and lots of pies, Christine says. She says when the pandemic is less of a threat, she hopes to celebrate with a large cookout with fellow farmers and people who've been purchasing their goods, helping them keep afloat during these uncertain times.
It's a little painful to not, you know, really get to spend time and talk and catch up with people. So we're going to do something big when it's all over and we can all finally be around each other whenever that ends up being.
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Caitlin Tan.
One in four women and one in nine men experience intimate partner violence, which can include physical injury or battery, psychological intimidation, emotional abuse, or sexual violence from an intimate partner. That's according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. Since the coronavirus pandemic and shelter-in-place orders were put in place, parts of Central Appalachia are seeing abuse and neglect calls decrease significantly. Experts are worried that this could be a sign of a bigger problem. Victims are stuck in homes with their abusers with no escape. 100 Days in Appalachia reporter Allison Stein spoke with experts in local shelters to find out more in an online report called In Appalachia, It's Always Hard to Leave an Abusive Home, Then Came a Pandemic. Hi, Allison. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what do you mean by in Appalachia, it's always hard to leave an abusive home? How are things different here than other places when it comes to escaping abuse?
Well, we have some factors about our region that may make us unique and also make some things difficult. We're more isolated in parts of the region. Parts of our area are more remote. And accessing all services can be more difficult. There simply may not be as many services. They may be harder to get to. We have low rates of public transportation in many areas. So if you only have one car, it may be hard to get to help sometimes. We also have populations with lower incomes. And one of the experts I talked to talked about how if people have resources, they tend not to go to a shelter. They tend to reach out at home.
And how is the pandemic making it harder for survivors of domestic abuse right now?
Well, the pandemic basically means reduced movement across the board. You are not going to work. Many people, children are not going to school. People can't even leave the house for an errand or to get a break. So people may be living with their abusers and be unable to take time off or even have an excuse to leave. Communication is also more difficult because of the pandemic. People may not have internet access at home, and libraries are closed, so you can't access the internet there. People may be running out of data or minutes on their cell phone plan. And so most of the avenues that people would use to access help are just a bit more hectic right now.
In your report, you mentioned that phone calls reporting abuse or neglect have basically stopped, not just here in Appalachia, but also in other places across the country, like in Colorado. But This is actually a concern for social workers or other abuse prevention experts, right?
Absolutely. It really means that people aren't able to reach the phone to call out for help, or that people aren't in front of mandatory reporters like teachers and coaches, or people who would see maybe signs of abuse happening and try to reach out for help. I talk about in the article, the first thing that my sister's place did when the pandemic hit this area is they started to make room. And it wasn't just that they knew they needed space between the beds and they needed to give every family their own bathroom, you know, for social distancing and safety reasons. But it was also that they did expect an increase. They expected that tensions would be running higher, people would be spending more time with their abusers, and things might come to a head. You know, people might need more help during this time than they would normally. And so they expected to have that flood of people coming. But the opposite has happened. People are less likely to be able to get out or even to feel comfortable or safe getting help. It's not a great time to leave your house, period, right? Even if you can, you know, it's not the best time to go to a hospital, even if you're hurt or need that help.
It seems kind of hard to talk about. Even as I say it out loud, my stomach kind of turns thinking about, you know, the needs and the people out there who can't get to the phone, but just in trying to see some kind of opportunity or hope. What are your thoughts about the workers getting an opportunity or a chance to catch up on some of these that have been sitting in, you know, stacks and stacks of papers for a long time?
I think that is true. I have a friend here in Appalachian, Ohio, who's a social worker, and people aren't showing up for their appointments, their counseling appointments, and that concerns her. And so she's trying to reach out to them in different ways. So I think there's two opportunities here. One is that my social worker friend, you know, she's using this extra time, if you will, to catch up on those backlogs, to check back in with people, to maybe revisit, you know, some old circumstances that she never followed up on, or, you know, the limited resources didn't allow her to. But I think another opportunity of this very stressful time is to maybe think about new ways to reach out and communicate. My sister's place, the domestic violence agency in Ohio, has set up a text line because they realize that even if you don't have internet at home, or you're almost out of minutes, or you have no data plan, sometimes you can still text, so people can reach out that way. A woman that I talked to who works in the social work department at Ohio University, she's an associate professor there. She talked about how this is really a time for us to check in with each other. This is really a time to, you know, call that friend you haven't talked to in a while, or knock on the house of that senior citizen and, you know, stand back on the porch and just ask if people are okay and really check in with each other. And we still do have opportunities for contact in the form of, you know, virtual calls and videos. And that's still a chance to check in on somebody and see how they're doing and just pay attention to what might be going on in their life and how you might be able to be there for them.
So for folks who might be listening who need help, the message is look for other ways to communicate rather than the traditional phone call or physically leaving. And for those of us who want to help, look for ways to, you know, pay attention to your neighbors and folks who we might know who live in these dangerous situations and be willing to sort of reach out and help with that is what I think I'm hearing, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's important to remember that domestic violence shelters are still open. They are classified as essential services and they're still operating. And they have gone to great lengths to keep the facilities safe and available to people that need them. So they're still there for people.
Thank you so much for your time and stay safe.
Thank you. You as well.
It's tough to imagine what so many are going through right now. I know there's suffering going on that we don't even know about. If you need support or want to report domestic violence, please call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-SAFE. We've also posted a link on our website, wvpublic.org. So we've heard a lot about Appalachian resiliency during tough times, and we wanted to end the show with something inspiring, a story about a program designed to empower young women and girls through rock music. Girls Rock Whitesburg in Whitesburg, Kentucky, is a music camp for female, gender-fluid, non-binary, and trans youth. Over the course of a week, campers learn an electric instrument, form a band, and write songs. At the end, they perform it in front of a live audience. Last summer, Folkways Corps reporter Nicole Musgrave followed two campers who reinvented a traditional protest song. So, let's hear some Girls Rock.
The name of the camp is Girls Rock, and today, that's exactly what they're doing. Meet Cheyenne, the drummer of one of the camp's newly formed bands.
My name is Cheyenne Gladson. I live in Cumberland, Kentucky. I'm 18 years old. I wanted to play music for a really long time because I go to a lot of shows, but I never played. But even though I obviously wanted to.
And Adeline, her bandmate.
I'm Adeline Allison. I'm from Harlan, Kentucky, and I'm 17 years old. I've always been drawn to music, but I've only played music with men, which is fine, but I've never really met any other women who play music before.
Whenever you're stomping, like, freaking stick your tongue out or wink, you're just like...
Girls Rock Whitesburg launched in the summer of 2018, part of an international network that supports camps like this all over the world. This is Cheyenne and Adeline's second year at camp. They both say last summer was empowering.
I was able to find some confidence musically and personally.
We don't really realize like how much of a necessity that is, you know, to have confidence in ourselves. You know, that's not conceited. That's not bad to love yourself, you know?
Cheyenne, Adeline, and their third bandmate, Lara Helene, are all camp interns this summer. So they're calling their band The Interns. This year, they wrote the camp's theme song.
Just a little chant for our girls to, you know, say out loud and remember that they're strong and they can use their voice and they can be loud. It's just such an important part for like all these young girls to remember because so many girls feel like they don't have room to talk, you know, or like even if they do, no one's gonna like value their opinion, but that's not true at all.
Voicing opinions, especially on social issues, is a big part of what Girls Rock is about. In addition to music instruction, campers participate in workshops on topics like sex ed and anti-oppression. And they discuss difficulties in their personal lives and conflicts they see happening in the world. This week, some campers have written songs about their experiences with bullying and sexism. Last year, Cheyenne and her band wrote a song called Melt the Ice to speak out against immigration and customs enforcement. Girls Rock Whitesburg is part of a long Appalachian tradition of protest music written by women.
Melt the ice! Melt the ice! Melt the ice!
Come all you poor workers, good news to you I'll tell. How the good old union has come in here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
That's Florence Reese in a 1980 recording, singing her song, Which Side Are You On? It was a response to the bloody labor struggles she witnessed in her home in Harlan County. During the 1930s, when Reese wrote it, other female activists in eastern Kentucky were also using music to speak out against injustices in their communities.
If you go to Harlan County, there is no neutral there. You'll either be a union man or a thug for J.H. Blair. Which side are you on?
In the song, she condemns coal operators and law enforcement, and she calls on miners to organize. On the surface, songs like Which Side Are You On that draw on the ballad and old-time music traditions might not seem to have much in common with the punk tradition that many girls rockers draw from. But there's more in common than meets the eye. The common thread is dissent. At Girls Rock Whitesburg, the traditions mix and meld. Organizer and music instructor Michella Phipps even has a name for it.
I just like to call us kudzu punks. Whether it's a fiddle or whether it's an electric guitar, it's kind of that same thing. We're telling stories and we're expressing things that happen to us in creative ways.
Carrie Carter, another instructor, sees the overlap between the past and present.
A lot of what happens in old-time music in like the 1800s and early 1900s is, you know, fighting against oppression and fighting the man and fighting systemic issues.
Cheyenne hears similar strains in the music she and Adeline are learning to play at Girls Rock.
Punk music's just kind of saying what you feel and what you like, what you think should be said, you know, like just expressing yourself and you can do that. Or they can definitely hear you because you're so loud, you know?
Following in the path of Florence Reese, the Girls Rock campers are learning the connection between music and activism. When it came time for the interns to choose a song to cover during their final camp performance, they chose Which Side Are You On?
The old song about the miners in Harlem, just because of like what's happening right now.
At the time of this interview, back in the summer of 2019, dozens of coal miners and their families had taken up residence in the middle of a train track in Harlan County, just 20 miles from here. They were blocking a shipment of coal to protest against their former employer, Black Jewel, which had recently gone bankrupt, laid them off, and then failed to pay their remaining wages.
My dad was playing that song when he was driving me home yesterday. We passed the protesters in Harlan, the miners who are protesting on the tracks in Cumberland. I've always loved the song, so it's kind of cool to see it be relevant again.
We're behind all the miners. Like, we support them 100%. Like, we want them to get their money. The company has still not paid them, and they're not really worried about it, you know? But the more people that we get in on it, I feel like they can't ignore us.
It's the final day of camp, and a crowd has gathered on a grassy hillside for the band's final performance. The interns play the camp theme song they wrote, along with a cover of the song I Want to Be Your Girlfriend by Girl in Red. They close their set with a performance of Which Side Are You On? Along with electric guitar, drums, and bass, the interns have added fiddle and banjo to their version, as a nod to the song's place in old-time music repertoires. Their bandmate, Lara Helene, introduces the song with words of support for the Black Jewel mining families.
Support miners. Support people over profits. Yeah. Support these mountains. It is a place worth fighting for and not just a place worth leaving. So this one is called Which Side Are You On?
Come all you good workers, good news to you, I'll tell of how the crippled mining has come here to dwell. Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
For Inside Appalachia, I'm Nicole Musgrave in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Today we heard from several people who are struggling to make ends meet and continue to keep their lights on during the pandemic. And so many people across the world are facing challenges right now, I can't even imagine. I'm lucky. I have a roof over my head. My family's healthy and by my side. One thing I hear in the people in today's show is a strong resiliency. We will persevere. We know how to do that because we've done it so many times before. Nothing quite like we're facing now, but I think we're all better and stronger when we lean into each other to face the challenges together. I know we're all facing a lot right now, but we all have something we could do to help our neighbors and friends across our region. We're going to need a lot more mutual aid in the months ahead. Send us your stories of kindness to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Stay well and keep doing good work. Till next time, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from the Ohio Valley Resource, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting, Report for America, and the Coalfields Reporting Project, which is supported by the National Coal Heritage Area Authority. Find more at coalheritage.org. Our theme music is by Matt Jackford. Our music this week was also provided by Dinosaur Burps, Blue Dot Sessions, and Marisa Anderson. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Glynis Board. We had help this week from Helen Barrington from PGMA's Editor Corps. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. Xander Alloy and Molly Bourne also provided production assistance. You can find us on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. Visit wvpublic.org/insideappalachia to sign up for the Inside Appalachia newsletter. There, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.